we'll invite all the speakers come to the stage, and we'll start to answer some questions. While we are waiting, I have a comment on your talk about the elderly. So elderly patients very intolerant to a couple of combination issues. So in younger populations, we can they can tolerate a degree of a pre-dialysis acidosis and post-dialysis alkalosis. Hemodynamically, it's relatively stable because of the sympathetic upregulation.
Mm-hmm.
And for the elderly, if they are on beta blocker, and they could be very, very susceptible to pre-dialysis acidosis, post-dialysis with a vasodilation.
Right.
And so that kind of situation, you had to be very careful with beta blocker. So it's a combination issues, multiple interventions.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning this, because, of course, you know, this was just pointing out some issues, you know, and I think there are more ideas, and I think when we think about treating elderly patients, we have to, well, look at many details, and I think we have learned over the last decade so much about treating or modifying our dialysis treatment. I think that we have a big source of experience.
Frank, you wanted?
Yes, I received the following question. Since the duration is critical during dialysis, a marked mark of perfusion, why do monitors do not have a module for continuous monitoring of the, I think it's a duration? There are at this moment devices available, if I may, may call the name, it's called Critline devices. A Critline is a technique that you will be able to measure both arterial, if you put it on the catheter, you measure central field saturation on the vascular access, you measure oxygen saturation. So there are machines available for measuring continuous saturation during the dialysis treatment. It's not in the device itself inbuilt, but it is a separate small device where you can adjust to the patient and to the treatment.
Okay, so maybe Dr. Weil, you want to take the next one?
Oh, sure.
Just to repeat the question first.
Oh, yeah, sure. I just read one. Someone wanted to know if we have more information about how drugs are removed by intensive therapies like continuous renal replacement therapy, and especially antibiotics. There's not a lot about how much is actually removed in dialysate. What we do know about antibiotics, and you can see this published, there's a lot of literature on the publication on this topic, is the sieving coefficient, which is usually done kind of in an in vitro setting. And the assumption then is that if the sieving coefficient of an antibiotic is high, then it'll be removed by continuous renal replacement therapy. But in terms of studies that look at the content of that antibiotic in the dialysate, that's not been done very frequently, as far as I know.
Mark, you want to take one of your questions?
Sure. I think that you know, for me, it seems there's a theme that there's a concern about ototoxicity associated
with the large dose.
Yeah, with the large dose mm-hmm. of loop diuretics, and I will say, you know, in reviewing the evidence from the trials, this is not a very, very common at all. I think that the, you know, in the experience in Europe and Japan would support the contention that ototoxicity at the kind of the levels that are usually used, 160 milligrams, 250 milligrams of furosemide, is rare. You should talk to your patients about it. Make them aware, but I don't see it as a major stumbling block to using diuretics in ESRD.
Just a quick question, a practical question. For large dose diuretics at Mayo, we use Solucets to give over the course of maybe an hour. Do you do that? Just kind of mitigate, like push bolus effects, you do that? Give over a course of an hour or 45 minutes instead of...
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, one could do that if you had the staffing and the...
The large dose.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Will, you want to take over?
Yeah, sure. So this is a two-part question. One, someone wants to know if we, if the information that we know about the dilute clearance of amlodipine is based on the active metabolite, and it is. Just same as the ACE inhibitor studies, those are just looked at the active, the fosinoprilate instead of the parent drug fosinopril. And then the other question is there evidence that drugs with a high volume of distribution actually kind of almost like leaching out of the tissues once it's cleared from the circulation by dialysis? And that makes a lot of sense, but I don't know of any study that's actually documented that. We do know that the drugs that are protein bound, if you remove the free component, there is a movement from the protein bound to the free, but in terms of actually coming out of tissue, it makes sense that drug, removing drugs from one compartment, they will come out of another one, but I can't stand here and say, I can't tell you what evidence there is, because I don't think there, that's
okay. Dr. Coleman, you want to take your next one?
Yeah, there's one question on the issue of atrial fibrillation in elderly patients, chronic or paroxysmal, what to do then with ultrafiltration target? Is it another cause of interdialytic hypertension and of congestive heart failure? Yeah, I think there are, in my experience, I think we have the atrial fibrillation which may be present before dialysis or start of dialysis, or atrial fibrillation occurring during dialysis. And this may rather be a sign of hypoxia, maybe a sign of too high ultrafiltration rate, as a compensatory mechanism, as Dr. Van der Zande pointed out, tachycardia, or increase in heart rate occurs. And if so, I think reduction of ultrafiltration rates is important. Reconsidering the target ultrafiltration rate would be something. And I think this is the typical issue with this atrial fibrillation.
Well, we have
the question that I received is, do you think that transcutaneous measurement of tissue oxygenation is useful? There are, I think there's one study performed on transcutaneous PO2 measurements, and normally it's used for studying microvascular abnormalities. In this study, in a small study using this PO2 measurements, about 50% of the patients had a decline in PO2 during the dialysis treatment. And that was related to a decline in blood pressure, ultrafiltration rate, and also change in peripheral vascular resistance. Only one study I'm aware of. So yes, it is used, but I think it's not. We cannot use it on the treatment-to-treatment base.
So
okay, Dr. Arnold.
Yeah, I'll yield to Dr. Bargman, who wants a microphone. Is that true? and while. While she's coming up, I guess, Martin, I was just curious. To me, the case that was described, the ethical principles that I face with elderly is that you want to individualize care, but there's a pressure, regulatory pressure, not to, right? So that's why, you know, when you did your survey question, a lot of people treat the elderly like they do everyone else. How do you have trouble with that at your unit? Like, if you wanted to do less frequent dialysis, for instance, you'd get banged on for having a non-adherent patient in the U.S.
Well, in Germany, you can do less than three treatments per week. And so we have a kind of flat rate for three treatments per week. Mm-hmm. But I think for the last 4 or 5 years now, it's possible to charge for two treatments, so it's possible to do this. And it's rarely done, I think. What about another, a fourth treatment, if patient requires that? That is not financed, actually. We can do this in the hospital, so that's what we do for some patients, and so we treat them in the hospital. It's a different financing system then, and we can charge each single treatment.
Just recently visited some Asia countries, and they are able to provide, especially with elderly, more PD, that's for sure, but once a week dialysis or twice a week dialysis.
Yes.
And sometimes
case,
it lasts for a while.
Yeah, interestingly, this case, you may have read this, they ended up treating this patient once a week, which I think is interesting to read. Might be interesting to discuss, is once a week treatment dialysis at all? Does it change anything? So, but this is a different discussion, I think.
You want to take
one? Yeah, Dr. Bergman.
Thanks a lot. I just have a couple of comments. First, I'll let you in on a secret that there was a study about a decade ago called the EPOS study that looked at dose of peritoneal dialysis in anuric PD patients. And in the original version of the paper, residual kidney function came out as a statistically significant predictor of outcome. And you can wonder how could residual kidney function be a predictor of outcome when it was in anuric PD patients. So it turned out as part of the entry criteria for that study, you were allowed to have 100 mils per day of urine volume or less. And even that little bit of residual urine volume, the average was about 70 mils, came out as a predictor of improved survival in these anuric PD patients. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they eventually took it out of the abstract because this was supposed to be about anuric patients. You didn't want to talk about residual kidney function. But it just gave me pause as to what is like an unimportant amount of urine volume. And it seems like maybe it's good to the last drop in terms of urine volume. And the second point I just want to say is that every study that has looked at it has found that urine volume is an important predictor of outcome. But what isn't clear is if diuretic-driven urine volume has that same influence on better outcome as opposed to sort of naturally occurring urine volume. And that still remains a question to this day. And then just finally for Martin, I want to say that in my province, Ontario, the Ontario Renal Network supports the idea of what's called palliative dialysis. Palliation, not meaning end of life care, but meaning relief of symptoms.
Yes.
And you're allowed to dialyze particularly the elderly, frail patient purely for relief of symptoms. And that's great. And unfortunately, I don't see it really getting traction, particularly in the United States, where people are so strangled by so-called quality indicators.
So, Dr. Onuru, you have any comments on the diuretic-induced urine output in dialysis patients? Or do we have some information?
No, I totally agree. There's a lack of information as far as whether or not that, you know, the use of diuretics in order to squeeze that last drop out of confers a major benefit. And, you know, a lot of this is association data. Even, you know, you could imagine even the not-so-anuric versus anuric patients, there are probably differences between those two groups. And maybe it's the urine. Maybe they have a little different physiology. It's hard to sort out. That's why you need kind of a larger prospective trials looking at this.
Martin, you want to?
Yes, we have another question. Most elderly patients have taken beta blockers, as by their cardiologist, it reduces sudden cardiac death. Well, it reduces sudden cardiac death, I think, in the non-dialysis population. We don't know exactly what that does in the dialysis population. And in my own experience, I think some elderly patients, even if they are not on dialysis, they complain about fatigue and less being able to walk and to exercise. So in these days, I think one also has to think about dosing of beta blockers. Sometimes they are very high dose, and lower doses may be sufficient. And the same, I think, is the case for the hemodialysis patients. If you see that the patient is not responding to drop in blood volume with a increase in heart rate, I think he's on beta blockers. Why not reducing the beta blocker dose at least?
Just another interesting observation is pre-dialysis acidosis in very elderly tend to centralize the fluids because there's a degree of vasoconstriction, venous capacitor venule constriction, but dilates at artery tend to centralize the fluids. So they don't tolerate pre-dialysis acidosis nearly as well as younger patient population. Matthew, you want to take your next one?
Yeah, actually, we were just discussing one about the change in non-dilated clearance in end-stage renal disease patients. And there is information, I think authored by my colleague, that that the activity of CYP enzymes changes and uremic toxins inhibit their function. And we actually have some of our own data showing that uremic toxins also inhibit the uptake of drugs from the GI tract through certain channels. So yes, the non-renal the non-dilate clearance of drugs does change with the course of a hemodialysis session, if you want to add to that at all.
Martin?
Yes, quite interesting question. How should we proceed when the very elderly patient previously on maintenance dialysis wants to withdraw from the therapy? Of course, if the patient wants to withdraw from the therapy, I think we have guidelines how to react. We have to, we know that the patient can withdraw. It's not a decision from one day to the other day. I think it needs talking to the patient, talking to, including the nurses, including the family of the patient, to find out what is the situation. But eventually, if the patient is has decided to withdraw from therapy, patients can withdraw, and it's their right to withdraw from dialysis. And I think then we can use palliative care in those patients. We can offer with dialysis to relieve symptoms. We can do it without dialysis treatment. So I think withdrawing from dialysis in the very elderly is an important issue and an important ethical issue, which has a legal background, at least I think in the United States, in Canada, and in Europe.
Frankie,
yes, I have two questions. The first one is isotretinoin ultrafiltration beneficial in hypertensive episodes, in hypertension? Isotretinoin ultrafiltration. For 20 years ago, we performed a study in measuring the amount of heat we removed during an ultrafiltration session. And in, when you ultrafiltrate a patient for 1 hour and you remove 1 liter, you remove about 100 kilojoules per hour of energy. The temperature in this patient will then decrease to about 34 degrees Celsius. So ultrafiltration leads to cooling down the patient. When we adjusted this information to hemodialysis session, we're cooling down the patient during hemodialysis combined with ultrafiltration, we had to set the ultrafiltration temperature to 35 degrees Celsius. So I think that ultrafiltration is not needed anymore, but you have to cool down the patients, or at least to prevent an increase in body count temperature, as Martin mentioned. So hemodialysis combined with ultrafiltration at a low dialysate temperature, 35.5, 36, or individualizing the body temperature. Adjust the body temperature and the dialysate temperature to match to them, and thereby preventing the increase in body count temperature. The second question I had received was, is sodium modeling along with ultrafiltration profiling useful? First regard to sodium profiling, there are some data from the past from Song and Song, two different investigators. We used the sodium profiling from high to low. And indeed, they found during the session an improvement in blood pressure. But the next session, because the patients were loaded with salt, they increased the water intake. And the next session, they had to be removed to more volume and had a decline in blood pressure. So sodium profiling, I don't think that is useful anymore. The second question, with regard to ultrafiltration profiling, there are some data, some crash scripts or some crash filing, high, low, high, low, high, low. They don't work. There's a linear decline in ultrafiltration profiling diet that might have a benefit in preventing hypertensive episodes.
Mark, actually, there's one question regarding the potassium-sparing diuretics. Are you taking into account of a gut aldosterone receptor effects in responding to oral, spironolactone?
I guess, sort of the question would be to what extent those would be changed or mitigated on dialysis, and I'm not sure.
There is some evidence showing some compensatory increase of gut aldosterone mm-hmm. receptor. In your experience, is there any? Do you take that into account when you consider spironolactone for dialysis population?
Right. I guess so. For me, that is kind of taken into account indirectly with the concerns about hyperkalemia.
Yeah.
And I guess that is related to a question that I got. What are your thoughts on the use of spironolactone in peritoneal dialysis patients? And, you know, to me, it seems like a relatively reasonable population to use spironolactone, although there are concerns about the gut. I think that the study that best addressed this was by Ito, which was published in JASN in 2014. And this study looked at the effect of spironolactone. It was 50 milligrams versus usual care over the course of 18 months. And it looked at LV mass using echo and demonstrated that the spironolactone was protective. In that population, there was very minimal hyperkalemia. They tended to have about 10 to 15% of the patients complain of gynecomastia, and that was the primary adverse event. So, you know, at least in the PD population, it appears relatively safe with the concern of an adverse event of gynecomastia.
Okay, that's very good. Matthew?
I got a comment saying that drug dialyzability is not the whole story. There's still renal clearance in people with end-stage renal disease, and that's totally I totally agree. Our studies have been conducted in anuric patients because we're trying to separate out the role that dialytic clearance makes. But adding to the complexity of this issue, yes, renal, and then also, as we mentioned, the uremic effect on CYP enzymes is another factor that goes into drug disposition in people with end-stage renal disease. And then I got a lot of questions about intoxications. So there are questions about protein binding intoxication, whether we should dialyze people with highly protein-bound drugs if they're intoxicated with them. And there are very few areas of medicine that are dominated by the case report literature, but this is one of them. There's lots of case reports. I think it's probably a case report for every drug that we know of, where someone took a lot of it, and then they got dialysis, and then they got better. And so there's not a lot to go on. My personal practice is that I err on the side of providing the treatment to an intoxicated patient. Even a highly protein bound drug will have used up all the albumin binding sites and will have a much higher fraction of free drug that may be dialyzable. There's not a lot of literature that you can stand on and say, I'm not dialyzing this patient because this drug is not dialyzable. So I choose the safer route, which is to err on the side of caution and provide the treatment if there's a chance it might be beneficial. So there, hopefully that's all the intoxication.
Okay, so we have our last round of questions. Frank, you have a couple.
Yeah, the question I received about the role of hypertension, of antihypertension medications play in hypertension episode during dialysis. I think the answer is clear. The answer is yes. But when a patient develops an hypertensive episode, I think it's very important first to look at his dry weight. Don't we remove too much fluid in this patient? First optimize his dry weight. And his dry weight is okay, then we can try to reduce the number of antihypertensive medications during the treatment, I think step by step.
Yeah, so I have a couple of questions. One is related to COPD. In frail elderly patients, hypoxia require oxygen administration in the unit. Many times they do worse past or during treatment, pulmonary hypertension playing a major role. So, this is a typical issue, COPD in elderly hemodialysis patients. Please keep in mind they have a risk of hypercapnia. So if hypercapnia occurs, it may also be due to a reduction in the breathing rate, but also maybe related to bicarbonate concentration in the dialysate. So if it's too high, maybe transferred into the patient and bicarbonate will be transformed to CO2, so reduced bicarbonate concentration. Check whether that helps. Next question would be maximum ultrafiltration rate in frail elderly patients. We discussed 10 mils per kilogram per hour. This was recommended by others as a maximum, okay? But I also support the autofeedback of ultrafiltration, which can be higher at start of dialysis and lower on average over the treatment. And the question is there a maximum ultrafiltration rate in the first few minutes of dialysis? Actually, I don't know of any recommendation. I think what we, you know, it's when we're talking individualizing treatment, we have to, as I pointed out, to discuss refilling capacity of these patients, and autofeedback can help, but make sure that you also look at the way you're assessing refilling capacity. For example, that's another question, use of the crit line in the elderly, that may help getting an idea about the refilling rate. And so what we have to prevent is intradialytic hypotension, but if it's possible, if it helps to have a higher ultrafiltration rate in the beginning, and then during the treatment, if you are successful, then that's okay to do.
Any more questions from audience? Go ahead.
One question for Dr. Weir regarding use of apheresis in protein-bound drugs, or apheresis.
I'll give you a quick answer.
Some nephrologists are okay.
Yeah, no. To use plasmapheresis for a protein-bound drug, I guess in a desperate measure you could, but it's not a topic I know much about. I know about the clearance of biologic agents with plasmapheresis, but that's not something I've come across. I had one other question I wanted to address on the card here.
Can I ask?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
I guess, you know, I was interested in the your use of cannabis, or your study of cannabis.
My study of cannabis.
Your particular, not your use.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Your use of it as a drug to study. How about that?
Yes. Yes. And the laws in the United States are not as progressive as.
No. It depends where you go.
Yeah.
So I guess you know, from your understanding of the pharmacology of cannabis, are all cannabinoids going to be cleared at the same rate?
That's a good question. The best physical property data we have is for THC.
Yeah.
But there are other cannabinoids that are not well characterized at all.
It's going to be a
ground up process in terms of.
Because I mean, it even depends like which product you get from where and at what time.
Whether you vaporize it, or smoke it. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
okay. Yeah. And you're studying. Aneuric patients.
Right now we're studying aneuric patients who smoke pot, and because you know we're meeting them on dialysis, collecting them on dialysis, we have to make sure that they are, you know, religious about their pot smoking. And they have all assured me that they're
religious.
They are religious about their pot smoking.
Okay.
So. Frank, you mentioned in passing. There's a low-grade lactic acidosis related to the hypotension or
Matin? To the hypotension.
Lactic acidosis hypotension?
Well, that's what I discussed. Yeah, I think if you're talking about oxygen saturation, I think lactate levels may be an indicator of chronic...
And to what degree of it's a small level of lactate?
Yes, you know, but you can observe in those patients that they have a small, slight increase in lactate levels pre-dialysis. So that's what we observed. So it's just, I don't have too many.
You might want to look
But I think it's interesting if we're discussing to kind of study or predict the risk of intradialytic hypotension, and we're measuring oxygen saturation. Maybe lactate may be another marker.
Yeah, the lactate low-grade lactate is related to the metabolic alkalosis.
Exactly. Yeah.
Stimulate. It could easily be stimulated by high bicarb dialysis.
Right.
Yeah. You were okay.
Hello. I had just one general question regarding volume of distribution of many of these drugs and dialyzability and bridging patients after a treatment to CRT, for example. I just want to know what your opinion would be on that, because it is...
So on bridging patients from CRT to...
So providing a treatment of intermittent dialysis to dialyze off whatever... toxin.
Oh, well, you're talking about like in an overdose.
Yeah.
Well, CRT is very inefficient. So if there's like a hemodynamic opportunity for the patient, then hemodialysis should be what is offered.
I guess, can I interject?
Oh, sure.
I guess it depends on what you're calling CRRT, right? Because currently with the machines, I mean, you can run blood flows as high as on dialysis, and it's just a smaller version of a dialysis machine. And so, you know, it gets a bit tricky.
I mean more for like a rebound effect.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously if they have the hemodynamics to run them on intermittent dialysis, sure, but...
Well, I mean, there's a lot of variability in the drugs that you were talking about. Some of them have, those that have a higher volume distribution will have a higher rebound effect.
Right.
And so those are the patients you need to dialyze down until the levels are as low as you want them to be, and then recheck the level in a couple hours without taking down your setup and sending the nurse home.
Thank you.
Oh, and I had one question about heart failure patients on dialysis and what beta blocker to choose, metoprolol or carvedilol. There are 360 people in the history of the world who have been involved in a randomized control trial of beta blockers who are also on dialysis. 140 of them were involved in a study that showed that carvedilol was superior to placebo in terms of controlling heart failure symptoms, and in a two-year follow-up of that study was superior in terms of preventing sudden cardiac death. So my choice for that reason is carvedilol. My choice for dialyzability point of view is carvedilol. My choice for just a potent antihypertensive medication is carvedilol. And my choice for not inducing diabetes is carvedilol.
But no conflicts of interest?
No. You know, like, there may be a day in my life where someone wants to pay me money to say something, but that day has not come yet. So I can swear I have no conflicts of interest.
Sounds great. With that, we conclude this session. Thank you very much.